Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Well, it has been a very busy news week. On Wednesday, the Senate voted for fast-track legislation, which gives President Obama the power to finalize the secret Trans-Pacific Partnership. Yesterday, the Supreme Court handed the Obama administration a major victory for the Affordable Care Act. We'll be doing an entire show about that on Monday. Today, the Supreme Court and same-sex marriage advocates made history by legalizing gay marriage across the country. The 5-4 decision guarantees a nationwide right to same-sex marriage. This morning, President Obama called the ruling a victory for America. He said, quote, "Progress on this journey often comes in small increments, sometimes two steps forward, one step back, propelled by the persistent effort of dedicated citizens. And then sometimes there are days like this when that slow, steady effort is rewarded with justice that arrives like a thunderbolt," end quote. Just hours after President Obama made those remarks, he will deliver the eulogy at a funeral for the Reverend Clementa Pinckney in Charleston, South Carolina. He was one of 9 people shot and killed on June 17th at the historic Emmanuel AME Church. Yesterday, services were held for Sharonda Coleman Singleton, a 45-year-old mother of 3, reverend, and high school track coach, and Ethel Lance, a 70-year-old grandmother who worked at the Emmanuel AME Church for more than 3 decades. Joining us to discuss coverage of these issues is Wesley Lowry, a national reporter covering law enforcement and justice for The Washington Post. Hi, Wesley.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome to the show. Great to have you. We're also joined by Leonard Pitts, a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Miami Herald. Hi, Leonard. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you. And Danny McLean is a Nation contributor and fellow at the Nation Institute. Hi, Danny. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Great to have all of you. Well, there's so much to talk about today, but as we always do on Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So let's start with you, Danny. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
You know, I have to say, I think there was some incredible reporting that came out this week. But my attention was really focused on some of the great thinking, the commentary, the analysis that was, you know, coming out around the Charleston massacre. I you know, admire the fact that you all lift up the reporting that is often unsung, because, you know, too often the people who are out there gathering news and uncovering the facts are overlooked. But just where my head was this week was, you know, focus on people like Kiese Lehman, who wrote an incredible piece about shame and forgiveness coming out of the Charleston massacre for The Guardian. A really interesting pieces about white fragility, or kind of reckoning with, you know, white mourners in the wake of the shootings at massacre. I'm sorry, the shootings in Charleston. I just think that there's a really important and interesting and rare conversation brewing right now around reconciliation and forgiveness and white supremacy, really, and it's a conversation that I haven't seen in mainstream news outlets very often. And so I was very, very interested to see that taking place.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because we'll talk more in depth about those very issues and how the media went about covering those. Thank you for that. That's Danny McLean, Nation contributor and fellow at the Nation Institute. What about you, Leonard? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, you know, it's funny, because the thing that affected me most deeply on a personal level wasn't even a piece that was written or reported as such. It was a short video that a reporter named Dan Dale of the Toronto Star, of all places — he's the Washington correspondent, I believe, for that paper — that he tweeted out, and it was a video of this predominantly, if not all, white crowd marching through Charleston, chanting "Black Lives Matter." And that was important to me, one, because I've become concerned, if not agitated, by this ideal of people trying to subvert the Black Lives Matter, you know, crusade by countering with "All Lives Matter," as if the one, you know, precluded the other, and as if there were not something very specific that's being said when you say "Black Lives Matter" that is necessary to be said in this era. So it was really powerful to me to see that, you know, those people embracing that chant. I wrote about it in a column, and I said that it was as welcome as lemonade on a hot August day. It was really a nice reminder that, and a needed reminder at this point, frankly, that compassion really has no color.
I saw that video also, and it's been shared so many times, probably for the very reasons that you just stated.
Yeah, it was really fantastic. You know, sometimes we get so caught up in this. In this sort of groupthink, they do this, they do that, why don't they understand? And we tend to forget that each they is made up of a bunch of different individuals, and that individuals all have different stories and different perspectives and take different routes to wherever it is that they are. Mm-hmm. So I was really I was moved. It wasn't just from a dispassionate journalistic point of view. It was as an African-American man in a very trying week for African-American people coming across this video and just really feeling invigorated by it.
That is Leonard Pitts. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the Miami Herald. And what about you, Wesley? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Of course. I think that one of the things that's been striking to me has been the last 2 days, as we've seen several major Supreme Court decisions, first with the Affordable Care Act, and now today with same-sex marriage or marriage equality. A lot of the work coming from two people in particular, one, Chris Geidner over at BuzzFeed. He's their legal editor and their lead kind of correspondent, and he's someone who I really enjoyed following, both for his kind of longer pieces where he's put a lot of this marriage equality fight as well as the ACA fight in the context, but also he's really great on social media. And then obviously my colleagues as well here at the Post, Robert Barnes and our team. I have really just enjoyed a lot of the coverage these last few days on what are large, humongous, monumental decisions that in many ways chart the course of our country moving forward. And those are always the opportunities to see great reporters doing their work on the highest stage. And so it's been excellent following that coverage.
And that is Wesley Lowery, national reporter covering law enforcement and justice for The Washington Post. And we will put links to all of the articles and also the video that Leonard mentioned at yourcallradio.org. Wesley, since you brought up good coverage of the Supreme Court decisions, I mean, this was a historic week for many reasons, and we're going to do a show about the ACA on Monday. The gay marriage ruling is also just a huge ruling for this country. What are your thoughts so far on the coverage of this? I mean, obviously many outlets had their stories ready based on the decision and put them out immediately, but has anything struck you so far about what you've read or heard?
You know, I think that in some ways, what's been striking is, and granted there's been coverage of this for a long time, but one thing that's striking is how quickly the country shifted on this issue. That just, 4 years ago, there were almost no states in the nation where there was any gay marriage legal at all. And now, 4 years later, the entire country, it's now legal. I mean, this is something that in terms of public perception, in terms of how it polled, in terms of where we have political candidates, you have President Obama giving what will be considered a historic address in the White House, and he was someone who ran for office in opposition to gay marriage. And not just the first time, but additionally during, as part of his reelection campaign. And so I think that it's a very fascinating shift in American society and American culture to watch how a social movement could so quickly grab the nation. And I think that that's been really reflective in a lot of the media coverage I've been reading.
What about you, Leonard? What has struck you about the coverage?
Again, I guess, I would repeat, this is the point about the speed with which this is, with which this has happened, and which it is, and with which it has come to seem inevitable and normal that it would happen. I've been, tracking some of my own older columns about this issue, and it was sort of the whole voice crying in the wilderness theme. The thing that I wish we would take a little bit more notice of, is the question of why this has happened, because it's my, my theory, and I've written about this several times, that a good part of this is that media, entertainment media, and I guess social media also, have mainstreamed, you know, what used to be frightening and terrifying to a lot of us have mainstreamed it to a degree that would not have been thinkable once upon a time. In that sense, you know, people like Ellen DeGeneres and the folks on Queer Eye for the Straight Guy and the cast of Will and Grace have sort of functioned in the same sense that Nichelle Nichols and Sidney Poitier and Bill Cosby did for the African American Civil Rights Movement 50 years ago. So it's really been fascinating, you know, to see that sort of parallel play out in media and in real life.
And in terms of where this goes, I think it's going to be so interesting to read about how this happened, to read about people who were brave enough, high-profile people who were brave enough. I'm thinking about some sports stars, for example, who have come out in the last couple of years. Leonard, what are your thoughts when you go to write your next column on this issue? You know, putting all these thoughts together on paper, where do you begin?
It's funny you should say that, because I was just brainstorming that with myself, and I want to say congratulations and good on you and all the rest of that stuff, but I want to say something a little more lasting than that. And the thing that occurs to me, again, looking at this through the prism of what we've seen with women's rights, what we've seen with African American rights over the last half century, is that if I would advise, you know, gay Americans to do anything, it would be to celebrate, but also to remain vigilant, because what I've seen, you know, with regard to African American civil rights and with regard to women's rights and other issues, is that, you know, rights once won are not necessarily sacrosanct, are not necessarily carved in stone such that they can never be eroded and or taken away. To me, that's been the lesson that we've seen with, you know, particularly in the years since the Civil Rights Movement, as we see the Voting Rights Act gutted, as we see, you know, other encroachments on gains that were made in those years that were once considered to be sacrosanct. So, you know, my advice, and what I'll probably say to Americans in general and to gay Americans in particular when I write next week, is enjoy this victory, but watch your flank.
Hmm. And Wesley, a lot of people are saying that now all of that money and those resources that were poured into gay marriage should now go to homeless LGBTQ and also the trans community. In fact, here in San Francisco, we just opened the first LGBTQ homeless shelter for people of all ages. It's called Jazzy's Place. And some people were surprised that this was the first time, but it is. And so, you know, a lot of people are saying, all right, the struggle continues. Now we need to put our resources into these areas.
Of course, you know, there's never any silver bullet to undo an inequity or an inequality. And so you have victories that are extremely important, today's victory being largely important. The voting rights victory back in the 1960s, both at Selma and then the leading to the voting rights legislation. But it would be false to believe then that, well, okay, well, blacks have the right to vote now, so now there are no more inequalities, there's no more issues with voting. And I think that applies here as well. You have issues with LGBT, the LGBTQ community, in terms of whether it be homelessness, whether it be terms with workplace discrimination. You still have many states that do not have laws on the books protecting LGBTQ people from that type of discrimination in the workplace. And so there are tons of other spaces in which there is still some inequality and inequity. And so this is a huge and large symbolic victory, but that does not necessarily mean that you're not going to still face some discriminatory issues in a lot of states, you know, and so this is a battle that's going to keep going on long beyond, you know, today's Supreme Court decision.
And Danny, you've been tweeting about the Supreme Court's historic gay marriage ruling. What do you make of the coverage so far?
You know, I think that one thing, so I appreciate Wesley's points about, you know, these kind of areas where those who care about LGBTQ rights and access will have to continue to fight. I saw a tweet this morning from someone who's really active in the Black Youth Project, Charlene Carruthers, saying, "What will HRC do now?" Which I think is a critical question, right? We've seen so much money mobilized in this fight for marriage equality. If the donors who, you know, have made this historic victory possible then shift their attention to issues of homelessness, you know, a range of other issues. It's incredible to think the kind of the additional victories that could be won. I think with the Supreme Court ruling, one thing that has stood out to me is the way that the way that family is being talked about, and the ways that, you know, there's quite a bit of language in the decision about how to exclude same-sex couples from, you know, the right to be joined through marriage. You're putting their children at a disadvantage because, you know, children of unmarried parents are harmed and humiliated in specific ways. And I that just really disturbed and disappointed me. It felt like the Supreme Court was upholding this belief that, you know, parents of single children of single parents are just inherently at some kind of disadvantage. And so I think we're already seeing the terrain on which we need to, you know, fight, right? I mean, there are ways in which the rights of single people, the rights of unmarried people are called into question through some of the language that we see in this decision.
And it was a 5-4 decision in the majority, Ginsburg, Kennedy, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Breyer. In the minority, Alito, Scalia, Roberts, and Thomas. Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion saying, quote, "The marriage laws at issue here thus harm and humiliate the children of same-sex couples." So again, this is an historic day. The Supreme Court made history by legalizing gay marriage across the country. The decision guarantees a nationwide right to same-sex marriage. We're talking about coverage with Danny McLean, a Nation contributor and fellow at the Nation Institute, Leonard Pitts, a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the Miami Herald, and Wesley Lowry, national reporter covering law enforcement and justice for the Washington Post. The Supreme Court also ruled in favor of subsidies for the ACA, which means the ACA is now the law of the land, and we'll be talking about that on Monday. If anything strikes you about the coverage of the Supreme Court decisions, we'd love to hear from you. We're also going to talk about the tragic shooting of 9 members of the historic AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. So much coverage of that. If you'd like to call in and talk about what you thought of the coverage, what really struck you about it, give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, especially if you have kudos. World Have Your Say had such an amazing show yesterday. Friends of Reverend Clementa Pinckney talking about not only his life, but some of the policies that he fought for. Health care for all. He fought for the poor. He fought for money to take money out of politics. It was just such a nice show. So if you have any kudos about what you've heard or read, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You have all written about this tragedy. You've all taken different angles. We have received history lessons. There's so much coverage about the Confederate flag, about racism. Again, World Have Your Say a couple days ago interviewed young people living in Charleston, just talking about everyday life, talking about what happens when a woman crosses the street, when a black kid walks down the street, just everyday life. And so what really stands out for you, Leonard, in how this story has really developed over the past week?
Well, I'm struck, you know, in terms of the Confederate flag, I'm struck by the speed with which the consensus, you know, that it's unfit for human consumption seems to have come about. I'm sort of reminded in a very odd way, and I wrote this in a column that hasn't published yet, but I'm reminded in a very odd way of the when the Berlin Wall fell. I don't think any of us, most of us at least, didn't see it coming. It was this sort of this thing that was never going to happen, and then suddenly, you know, it happened. And I feel the same way about what apparently is the fall of the Confederate flag. It's this thing that we've sort of been complaining about for years, but at least I never had any real expectation that it was going to happen anytime soon, mm-hmm. and suddenly it does. That said, one of the things that frustrates me about the coverage is that, you know, it seems to presuppose this whole idea that something about the flag changed, or that there was something different about the flag after, you know, Dylann Roof was seen posing with it on his Facebook after having allegedly committed this massacre. And that really troubles me. The Confederate flag is no more or less a racist symbol now than it was before Mr. Roof walked into that church. The only thing that's happened is that, the flag still represents what it has always represented. The only thing that happened is it became less possible for us to ignore what it represented. And, you know, the thing that I would argue is that it's a failing of our of media, and it's a failing of our educational system, that it was ever possible for so many of us to ignore what the flag has always stood for.
What about you, Wesley? What strikes you about how the story has developed?
Of course, I think that was really fascinating, was this idea that this symbol, especially in the South and many of the Southern states that for so long had been untouchable, something that people could insist that, you know, they were not racist, they were not prejudiced, they believed in equality, and yet they supported having this flag fly. It was striking how quickly people gained the public courage to now speak out against that or take steps to take down these flags, whether it was in South Carolina and Mississippi and Georgia and Virginia and many other states, that we are now having a conversation that for a long time we were unable to have. I think that it speaks to, and also, frankly, how that support for taking down the Confederate flag in many places cut across ideological lines. You know, on issues of race, especially in the last year, year and a half, even going back, I'd say the entire second Obama term, we've been having a constant flow of conversation about race and incidents that somehow are underpinned by race. And the refrain from the right very often has been, from conservative commentators and Republican elected officials, very often has been, this is not really about race. Trayvon Martin is not really about race. Michael Brown is not really about race. What was striking in Charleston was the acceptance across the spectrum, perhaps for the first time in recent history, that this event is in fact about race. This in fact was about race. It was about racism. And I think that was what empowered so many people, you know, even people who would otherwise be inclined not to support taking down a Confederate flag. I think that is what empowered them to take that position and take that position publicly. I just finished reading a column from Charles Krauthammer, one of the leading conservative thought leaders and Republicans in the country, arguing that this is something we had to do, was to take that flag down. And I think that that is really powerful. Those are kind of words you wouldn't expect.
Well, Leonard, what's interesting is in one of the columns you wrote, you basically wrote kind of a letter to some of the hosts on Fox News and some of the Republicans who initially said this was about religion. He went into this church to kill Christians, right? And then we learned that he had a desire for starting a race war. And then we saw photos of him standing with the Confederate flag. So, I mean, I hate to ask this question, but what if we didn't know that he wanted to start a race war or that he stood in photos with the Confederate flag? I mean, where would we be right now?
We would be in the same place we always are. This would be an Adam Lanza case, as in Newtown. It would be, you know, and I hate to use this term, a typical quote unquote American mass shooting. You know, it is a terrible thing to even have to say, as opposed to this sort of you know, racially inspired American mass shooting. The fact of the matter is, and the reason that I wrote that column is that one of the problems that we have in this country, and Wesley sort of alluded to this, is anytime we have a chance to ignore, obfuscate, excuse, get away from, you know, what's happening and has happened in this country with regard to race, most of us, or too many of us at least, will take it without a second thought. So, you know, the column that you're referencing, I essentially called out a few people for, you know, stuff that they said. This is after, you know, because the police said pretty immediately, we believe this is to be a hate crime. We're investigating it as a hate crime. They had the lady who came on, I believe, that the same night and said that the suspect had said, you know, you're raping our women, you're taking over our country, you have to go. Okay. Right. And even after this, you've got Elizabeth Hasselbeck saying this is a crime against faith, and you've got Glenn Beck sort of, you know, he's pretending this sort of confusion over, is it race, is it anarchism, is it this, that, and the other. So it's sort of more of the same thing of, you know, we'll never talk about it until or unless we're pushed against a wall. And I think that's what happened. And you're right. If those things had not surfaced, I'm sure that people would have found some sort of excuse to make this about anything but race.
Leonard Pitts is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Miami Herald, and the piece that we were just referencing is called A Racist Hate Crime, Pure and Simple, and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. You can also find the writing of Danny McLean, a Nation contributor and fellow at the Nation Institute, at our website, and Wesley Lowry, national reporter covering law enforcement and justice for the Washington Post. So what stands out for you in terms of how the story's developed in the past week about the tragic shooting of 9 members of the historic AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina? When we come back, we'll continue talking about this issue. We'll also talk about coverage of gun control and also race. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. If you have a perspective that you've not yet heard in today's discussion or a question that you'd like to ask our guests, please feel free to join the conversation. by calling 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free call. If you'd rather drop us an email, the address is feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can simply post your question or comment on the website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Inflection Point with Lauren Schiller. And then at noon today, the Tavis Smiley Show here on KALW San Francisco, local public radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will talk about the Affordable Health Care Act. The Supreme Court upheld the ACA's federal subsidies for over 6 million people. So how has the ACA affected your coverage? What is in store for the future of health care in this country, especially for those who don't have it or have it but aren't really able to go to the doctor because it's still too expensive? Trudy Lieberman has an excellent piece in this month's Harper's. If you can get your hands on that, be sure to check it out. That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, and what a week for news this week. The Senate voted for fast-track legislation on Wednesday, which gives President Obama the power to finalize the TPP. We recently did a show about that. Find it at yourcallradio.org. Today, the Supreme Court made history by legalizing gay marriage nationwide in all 50 countries. Today, President Obama is delivering the eulogy at a funeral for the Reverend Clementa Pinckney in Charleston, South Carolina. And we're talking about coverage with Wesley Lowry, national reporter covering law enforcement and justice for The Washington Post, Leonard Pitts, a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Miami Herald, and Danny McLean, a Nation contributor and fellow at the Nation Institute. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. What really strikes you about all of the coverage that you're reading and hearing about the shootings in Charleston, South Carolina, and some of the other shootings? Who's connecting the dots with these issues? What do you think about how the story is really progressing? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hey, morning. I was kind of struck by both of the rulings from the Supreme Court as being relative to equal justice under the law, and then also united you stand, divided you fall. So for years, various races, whether it's lynchings or just other types of discrimination, that's clearly not equal justice under the law for both protection as well as use of public property. And then, the idea of marriages, the idea of whose religion is better than others. So it's kind of funny, with this whole Confederacy issue, it is falling apart fast in the South because it's starting to be recognized down there that it's not equal justice under the law, since blacks are taxpayers as much as whites, that they are not getting equal use of public services, and that the bigots who are running the show are stealing the money. They're stealing the money from the white taxpayers as much as they're stealing it from the blacks. Post-Katrina showed that all of the billions sent down to Louisiana, that money never ended up fixing the potholes or repairing the levees or anything else. It just got plain stolen.
Well, thank you for calling in. To your point, in another decision, which I heard about on Democracy Now! This morning, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of allowing disparate impact discrimination lawsuits under the Fair Housing Act. A disparate impact would apply to cases such as setting income standards that would disadvantage a racial group. So this is also really important. And Danny, we did a show a couple months ago, and then Fresh Air also did a show about discriminatory housing policies, right? So, for example, the projects. How do they become the projects? Why is it that once blacks moved in and whites moved out, the services just ended? The trash wasn't collected. These kinds of things. And so it seems like these stories, this history lesson is actually starting to get a lot more attention in the media.
I think so. I mean, I think to me this has been, to me what's interesting about this moment is that you have some real soul searching, I think. As one of your other guests mentioned earlier, it's so frequently the case that, you know, the American public doesn't want to make things about race. And we're in this moment where it seems to be that people are kind of up for this real interrogation of, and not just race, right, but whiteness and white supremacy. I think, you know, some of the most interesting things coming in the wake of the Charleston shootings have been these think pieces that are actually really rich. And, you know, you have white women writing about, you know, not in my name, you know, this Dylann Roof stood up and said, you rape our women and you're taking over our country. And no, not me. You're not going to carry out these white supremacist acts talking about, you know, defending white purity and white femininity. We're seeing these, as I mentioned at the top of the show, these really like heartfelt investigations of like, what is the toll that it takes on the soul to constantly be asked to be the bigger person as a black person in this country, mm-hmm. you know, to constantly, you know, assume best intentions, to constantly be, you know, forgive them for they know not what they do. What is the psychic toll that takes? The Nell Irvin Painter, the incredible historian, had a piece in the Times last weekend. And I believe the headline was, what is whiteness? You know, really asking readers to interrogate the history. How is it that, you know, the Irish, the Italians, all these kind of ethnic groups came to be white? And you know, how does that connect to these, you know, current conversations about white privilege? So I think what's interesting is that, you know, we have Dylann Roof as a white supremacist. And we have this terrible news event, this terrible, you know, massacre coming on the heels of the Rachel Dolezal, you know, story. And it pains me a bit to even mention her name because she was so overexposed. But I think the connection is that, you know, here we have this white woman passing for black, which for some people was so shocking. Like, what could possibly be the benefit of, you know, passing for black? But what was clear from what she did was that she didn't have, and I think there are white people in this country who don't have a sense for the history of white people allying themselves with the black liberation struggle, right? So if Rachel Dolezal had been more informed about a John Brown, about a Cheney and Schwerner, about, you know, the many, you know, the white people that, you know, helped found the NAACP or were Jack Greenberg and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, what, you know, is it possible to develop an idea of whiteness that incorporates something other than a sense of shame, so that we don't see these polar opposites of either white supremacy or kind of shame around whiteness? So I think, yes, we are in this moment of incredible history lessons and a moment where there are really important conversations about whiteness that I haven't seen in the mainstream in the past.
Mm. Danny McLean is a Nation contributor and fellow at the Nation Institute. Leonard Pitts is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the Miami Herald. Wesley Lowry is a national reporter covering law enforcement and justice for the Washington Post. You can join us at 866-798-8255. What really strikes you about how this story has really developed in the past week, in the past months, in the past years? What are your thoughts on what you've been reading and hearing? What about the voices you've been hearing? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. With the proliferation of social and digital media, there have been so many more black public intellectuals and professors really filling the media gap. Filling the gap in media coverage when it comes to these issues, the history of racism, racial inequality. We're seeing so many more blacks on television, for example, offering their commentary. Leonard, how do you see their role in changing the conversation about race and class? I mean, how long have you been writing your column?
I've been writing this column since 94. So that's 21 years.
Okay, so you've seen a lot of change. What are your thoughts about how their role, your role, in changing the conversation about race and class, especially in the aftermath of this shooting?
You know, if you're asking specifically about my role, it's sort of, it depends on what day you catch me and what time of day you catch me. There are times when there's, you know, I'm in just great despair of the ability to communicate anything to anybody about what race really is and how it acts in this country. And then there are times when, you know, you are amazed at the absolute clarity with which these things get through. So, you know, that's kind of an up and down. In terms of what intellectuals, African-American professors and academics have brought to this discussion, I am really heartened by, you know, as I believe it's Danny said, this the fact that they are able to sort of bring a context to the discussion and a richness to the discussion that is often missed. One of the problems that we have in this country, we're always talking about we want to have a conversation on race. The plain fact of the matter is that most of us in this country are not qualified to have that conversation because we don't know anything. We don't know what we don't know. We don't care what we don't know in terms of the history of race, in terms of how we got this way. So before there can be a conversation, there has to be some education. I try to contribute what I can to that discussion, but I'm particularly heartened by, you know, Nell Irwin Painter and Matt Ray and people of this nature who have contributed, scholarship, to the discussion to sort of give people more of a textured and depthed idea of what it actually means when we say race, what it actually means when we say white or black. There are people who have this idea that there is some sort of objective scientific standard that you're talking about when you say, oh, so-and-so is white. And, you know, they don't understand that this is a social construct and why it's a social construct and what it means and what it has meant that it's a social construct. So that's the education that is sorely needed in this country. And I'm glad to see, you know, whenever and whatever vessel that comes through, I'm really just glad to see it.
Wesley, what would you add to that?
I think that's a really good point. And I think the one thing that as we look at, and this has been the case both with same-sex marriage as well as what we're talking about now in Charleston and what we've been talking about for years in terms of equity, in terms of race and prejudice in this country, is that I think what we've seen, especially through social media and the internet by and large, is we've seen people who have otherwise would have been unempowered, who may have remained voiceless, who have now been empowered to tell their own stories and therefore to mobilize themselves in a way that previously they weren't. One thing that social media has done, and digital media has done, is it's allowed the 17-year-old kid who lives in Ferguson, Missouri, who otherwise may never have had much of an outlet. Theoretically, he could have written a letter to his local newspaper, maybe. He might have, you know, had his story told by a columnist or in the paper, maybe. But now what we've seen is people who feel impacted by these issues, no matter what they are, whether it be police shootings, whether it be the inability to get married, can now voice their own stories. And the beauty of social media in some ways is that it's a democratic process. The content, the best content, the most compelling content rises to the top and gets sent nationally and internationally. And so what we're seeing so often, I think it's one of the reasons we're seeing so much movement on issues that for so long had seemed stalled, is that so much more quickly people can tell their own stories in their own voices with their own faces, with their own images, of their own lives. And that human connection is what empowers people and is what changes minds and changes opinions on what are otherwise very charged issues.
Danny, do you want to jump in there?
I'm just sitting here nodding vigorously because the idea that that there's police violence that is, you know, a reality in black communities. The idea that vigilante, you know, someone like a George Zimmerman or the man who shot Renisha McBride is kind of creating unsafe situations for black people all over the country. There's nothing new about this, right? But the difference is that in the past 2 years, certainly, perhaps even further back, we've seen the power of social media and specifically Twitter and specifically Black Twitter in making sure that these stories are not just isolated local stories, which is what they, you know, had been in the past, but that they quickly rise to the level of a national news story. And not only that the coverage is there, but that the framing is right, or that the framing is something that takes into account the perspectives of, in that example, black folks. So I am amazed by the way that Twitter has forced editors and, you know, news media to really pay attention and to connect the dots and to tell stories in a particular way that we just didn't see 5 years ago.
We were really struck to see media outlets interviewing Dylann Roof's friends. A few of them said he talked about his plan to, quote, kill a bunch of people at a local college about a week before the shooting, but no one took him seriously. And yet the people who interviewed the friends didn't really react to that, to say, well, why didn't you intervene? Or, you know, that your friend had
racist views and wanted to kill people. Where does this come from? Can you please elaborate on this comment? I was just surprised that there weren't any follow-up questions to hear these young people talk about their friend wanting to kill other people and be so racist. Did any of you, were any of you struck by that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Wesley?
I was going to say that, yeah, I certainly was struck by that. But I think that for some of us, I think we're shocked at this lack of questioning. But in many ways, I actually thought it laid bare one of the enduring issues we have here. This idea, I mean, in some ways, it speaks to this idea of the devaluing of black life, that it would be commonplace or it wouldn't raise an eyebrow that you would have someone saying these types of things. You know, he said racist stuff all the time, but he was joking. You know, and I think that really speaks to the mindset of in many cases pockets of America and pockets of white America. This idea that, you know, some of the initial quotes that, you know, yeah, we heard Dylan say these racist things, but I mean, we thought he was joking about killing all the black people. and I think it really was striking. And in some ways, sometimes that subtlety is in fact more powerful than hammering someone with a repeated question. You just let the absurdity sit there.
Leonard, you also wanted to say something there?
Well, Wesley just said everything that I would have said. It does kind of speak to the, you know, not just, I think, the way that we value or do not value African-American life, but just the way that we value or do not pay attention to hatred in general. You know, we sort of have this this environment where it's, at least among some people, you know, it's sort of anything goes and you can say anything that you want about certain marginalized groups. Certainly, you know, I can imagine the same scenario transpiring if somebody said, you know, I would like to kill a bunch of Muslims. I can imagine that. Or I'd like to kill a bunch of gay people. I can imagine his friend saying, oh, well, he said this stuff all the time, but we didn't really pay attention because we've sort of countenanced an environment where that sort of thing is, in some odd way, okay, or at least expected, or at least the norm. One of the problems that I have, particularly with certain segments of the media, is the way that they have sort of given aid and comfort and intellectual cover to this kind of, you know, it's essentially just hate speech. Mm. It's fascinating to me when I see, you know, the argument of the rhetoric of a Ku Klux Klan or the rhetoric of some, you know, anti-gay group or whatever, sort of cleaned up, polished, and fitted with a three-piece suit, and then repeated on Fox News or repeated on the Rush Limbaugh program. Mm. You see what I'm saying? The stuff is out there in different forms all the time. So in a sense, you can't be surprised that people are not surprised when they hear it.
Well, and how do you think the media should deal with that issue? Because when I heard that Governor Nikki Haley is calling for the death penalty of Dylann Roof, you know, my first reaction was, then what? I mean, if you kill this man, and then what? Do you just move on? I mean, how do you cover that? Like, to think about where he got these ideas, what role does the media play? What role does this inflammatory speech play that we hear on a regular basis in this country? How do you think the media should deal with those issues, Leonard?
Well, let me say first, I'm so uninterested in the death penalty for Dylann Roof. I don't know, you know, who it brings back or what it accomplishes. But, you know, that put aside, that said, you know, the thing that troubles me about media coverage of issues like this is, you know, in terms of media, I would tend to argue that we don't cover race in this country hardly at all. What we cover is the race circus, the stuff that happens out of race. We cover the Rachel Dolezals, and we cover, you know, obviously tragedies like this, and we cover, you know, the Fergusons and the Baltimores. But we're not in there in a proactive way covering the conditions that, you know, from which this kind of stuff springs. So it's always a surprise to us. It's always a new thing to us. We're always, you know, in terms of news media, we're always the kitten chasing the shiny object. You know, as opposed to maybe, you know, sitting down and to extend the metaphor, you know, studying the shiny object and trying to figure out what it is and why it has such fascination and why it recurs so much in our history. We don't talk about race and poverty until you know, something tragic happens to dramatize it. We don't talk about race and justice until there's a, you know, some kid lying dead, you know, on the street in Baltimore or in Ferguson or wherever. We don't talk about, you know, gender. We don't talk about all of these things until or unless we're pushed to do so by some tragedy or by some circus event like Rachel Dolezal. And at that point, I would argue it's kind of too late.
Hmm. Well, I hope that the documentary 3.5 minutes gets the attention it deserves. It focuses on Jordan Davis, who was killed in November 2012 in a gas station parking lot in Jacksonville, Florida, by a white man, Michael Dunn, who said that Jordan and his friends were playing their music too loud. It happened in just 3.5 minutes, and it's an amazing documentary. We're actually going to have a show on July 20th. I believe it opens that week in the Bay Area. And Wesley, I bring this up because you interviewed Ron Davis, Jordan's father, who's prominently featured in the documentary, an amazing man. And I was really struck by what he told you. He really summarized the events from Sanford, Florida to Charleston, South Carolina. He said, quote, "When you think about what has been done to us in this country," he's a black man, "when you think about slavery, when you think about the Tuskegee experiment, when you think about housing, when you think about voting rights, all of these things that we as people of color had to endure, and we did that, and we still want to assimilate with white people. We are the most forgiving people in the world." I mean, I get chills saying that, but that right there says it all. Wesley, what was it like for you to sit down with Ron Davis?
Of course, and I sat down with him as he was getting ready to get on a plane to go down to Charleston. His former wife, Jordan Davis' mother, was already down in Charleston. And that was what we were talking about. We were talking about the string that connects all of these issues. If you go back to 2012, Sanford, Florida, to Trayvon Martin. Later on that year, Jacksonville, Jordan Davis is killed. We see Oscar Grant, which has happened previously, but the film came out in 2012, in 2013. Then to Ferguson, to Eric Gardner, to Cleveland, to North Charleston with Walter Scott, now back to Charleston. One of the linking issues here was this idea of the hazard of black skin. This idea that in so many of these cases, it seems that otherwise innocuous circumstances, you know, committing a small robbery and then jaywalking, or listening to loud music in a gas station parking lot with your friends, being a child playing with a toy gun in a park, selling loose cigarettes, situations that Americans find themselves in every single day, why were these Americans, these young men, finding themselves dead? And again, the linking theme, the idea here, is this hazard of black skin. Why is the experience of a black American so fundamentally different? Why do you end up dead for something that a white American, you know, would go on living their life through? And that was something that we really talked about. And the documentary is excellent, 3.5 minutes, which will be coming out later this month. It's really well done, kind of showing, taking us back into the courtroom. One of the things I wrote is this idea of it. They do this documentary in a bubble. You know, this was a trial that took place in 2013. This is a world that was completely different than the one we know now. There was no Ferguson. There was no Michael Brown. There was no Eric Gardner. There was no big conversation about race and policing. It was a specific conversation. It was about stand your ground laws. It was about Florida. It was a different America. 2013 was a fundamentally different world than even America 2015. And that was one of the things that I think makes this documentary so fascinating, is going back to the roots of this current conversation.
Yeah, and again, we're going to have a show with Ron Davis and the filmmaker on July 20th. And 3.5 minutes, put on your list. It's an amazing film. We have an email from Joe who says, "A day or two after the massacre, I heard a very smart AME pastor, maybe from Maryland, on World Have Your Say. He referred to the myth of redemptive violence as a causative factor for this and other similar violence in our culture. I was intrigued by this. What I appreciated was the attempt to think about these issues in broader terms, instead of always reflexively returning to gun control, for example. Joe writes, Canada and Norway both have higher rates of gun ownership than we do, yet gun violence is rare. It's not just that we have access to guns, it's who we are, and we need to interrogate who we are if we want to understand what we do. I appreciate this kind of thinking." Danny, any thoughts on that?
I think that that's a really insightful email. And as I mentioned earlier, I think that we are in the midst of an important conversation around who are we as Americans. It's this phrase that he used, the myth of redemptive violence. I think, you know, there's this incredible conversation, and this relates to the quote that you read from Jordan Davis's father, but this idea of forgiveness, and, you know, is forgiveness possible without accountability, without atonement, and the role of righteous anger. I think there's this really critical conversation happening right now around anger. And, you know, is the media promoting an idea, or some corners of the media promoting the idea that Black people do not have the right to feel their anger, right? And that do we not have a right to kind of be legitimately angry and to rest in that place before we immediately move to some place of forgiveness? You know, I wrote the piece I wrote in The Nation last week after the shooting was that, you know, I see, for me, there's this question of not forgiveness. I wouldn't use that word, but kind of maintaining an open heart, or maintaining a willingness to believe in the goodness of people, so that we don't. So that we don't shut down and become engulfed in a bitterness that takes our own humanity away. I'm very interested in that. And I think that there's a way that conversations like that have typically been, like, either in kind of, Christians or religious circles, New Age circles, therapeutic circles, social justice, you know, circles that are very focused on trauma. And suddenly these conversations are happening in the mainstream. And I think it's important, and I think it's really beautiful for this country.
Hmm. Well, we have just about a minute and a half left. Danny, what are you working on right now?
I'm thinking about the ruling, the same-sex marriage ruling, and the ways that, you know, as I said earlier, unmarried people are being, you know, kind of held up as, well, we don't want these unmarried people, you know, the children of unmarried people are obviously in this negative situation, and we've got to save the children of those in same-sex marriages. So I'm thinking about that and working on something on that.
And Leonard, what are you working on right now?
Working on a piece spun out of the same-sex marriage ruling. As I said a moment ago, my thinking is, okay, what now and what next? And as I said, it's time to celebrate, but it's also time to watch your flanks.
Mm-hmm. And Wesley, what about you?
I think I'm going to be obviously watching the continued coverage of the same-sex ruling, same-sex marriage ruling today, but then also, going back to a big project we're working on police shootings, and we'll have probably a new installment in that coming out sometime next week.
All right, and we also got an email from Joe about another Supreme Court ruling related to what we're talking about, really. There was an important criminal sentencing case decided this morning, authored by Scalia, invalidating one part of a three-strikes provision in a federal statute. Quite an amazing week for SCOTUS all the way around. Thanks for that, Joe. Wesley Lowry is a national reporter covering justice for The Washington Post. Leonard Pitts is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Miami Herald. And Danny McLean is a Nation contributor and fellow at the Nation Institute. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Hi, I'm Harry Shearer, host of The Show, a weekly romp through the worlds of media, politics, and show business, delivered sans apology, along with an eclectic mix of mysterious music. And in the Bay Area, you can hear The Show only on KALW every Sunday at noon. Join me, won't you?
Behind every image, behind every word, there is something I am trying to tell you, something that really happened.
The best public radio stories, documentary audio, podcasts, big ideas, and cool sounds. It's all on Public Radio Remix.
Sunday morning, 6 o'clock.
here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco, online, KALW.org. The time now is 11 a.m., and we continue with our weekly presentation of Inflection Point.
Welcome to Inflection Point, interviews with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Technology is advancing so quickly. Are humans becoming obsolete?
There was, for a long time, this divide, and there were the people who were like, let's go to digital detox summer camp, and oh my God, turn off your technology, turn it off. We're going to have robot overlords. And then there are the people who were like, I'd like a chip.
Or are humans still at the center of solutions?
The human part of human-centered design is let's go out and understand the people that we're designing with and for from the start.
Designing the future for humans, that's our inflection point. I'm Lauren Schiller. Stay tuned.